Hello and welcome to the Real Film Podcast. We have another episode of the review show today, presented by Real, hosted by me, Corey Jordan, and...
and me, Phil Wilson. Have we ever done full names before? We're full naming each other now. We're doxing.
Well, I've realised, what if people out there want to know who we are and we're just saying Phil and Corey? How many Phils and Coreys are there in the world, you know?
None like us. None like us.
Actually, I don't really know many other Coreys, if I'm honest. Maybe I'm the only one.
I know. No, to be fair, there's other Corey as well.
Oh, there is other Corey as well.
That is such a niche joke for us.
I don't. Even, no, it's not a niche joke. That. It's just an inside joke that no one understands.
Yeah, and we're going to keep it that way.
So today we are reviewing four new films to 2024. We're going to talk about Dune 2, Netflix film, The Irish Wish. Madam Web, and another Netflix film, Damsel. And then we will, of course, have our Real Rewind, slightly different today, in which we're not specifically talking about old films we've watched, more so unique viewing experiences that me and Phil have had recently. We thought it'd be cool to talk about. And just one more thing before we get right into it. This will be a spoiler podcast. I know for all those Irish Wish fans that just can't wait to watch it. No, but more specifically for Dune, I think it's hard to talk about that film without spoiling it.
Yeah.
So we can just go into a bit more detail. Phil, Dune 2, obviously the part two, clearly. Directed by Denis Villeneuve, and the follow-up to his great part one from 2021. What did you think?
Really loved it. I don't think I'm quite on the level that, like, I see a lot of people saying this is like a five-star masterpiece. I'm not quite there yet, but the reason it's yet, and I think I've said this with other films in the past, it is very, very much a middle film. And that isn't to knock it, but when you haven't seen, and I said this about the first one as well, like I have given the first one a 5-star now because of how I think the things that are set up pay off in part two. And it's going to be the same thing if and when Villeneuve makes Dune Messiah. There's lots of things in this that are set up to be followed through in another film. It doesn't feel like the story is complete. So I think it's difficult to have a full rounded opinion until you see what the end for all of these characters is. That being said, there is something about the way Villeneuve makes these large scale epic stories that I think has been missing in cinema for a while. I think there's a very fair comparison to be made to Lord of the Rings here, where you just get big, epic, fun, but also incredibly well made. Like, we've had some really big films, but it's very rare that you get this kind of a blockbuster with tons of money behind it, a huge cast, has this far-reaching sort of story that is also just incredibly well made. It usually is either fun or has that kind of level of artistry, and this is, I think, as I say, I think the last time we saw something that did both to this level was probably the Lord of the Rings trilogy, in my opinion at least. No, I loved it. I think it was great.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, I know obviously we're both big fans of Denis Villeneuve anyway. My opinion alters slightly in the sense that I'd be happy to give, I agree that I do feel like this feels like a middle part to a bigger story, but I would be happy to give that film a 5-star at face value. But because, I mean, I think I know now, obviously, you say with like Two Towers, for example, maybe you're just waiting for that ending. But I think I'd still give that just a 5-star anyway. Not I know now, because Lord of the Rings has obviously been completed for a long time, you would give that 5 stars because you know like it's part of a larger story. But I, to be honest, I still wouldn't give Dune 2 5 stars. It's a very high 4 for me. I think I do agree it does feel like a middle film. But I There is something about maybe sort of like the last, not the maybe not the like the climax of the film, because I think that's brilliant. But maybe somewhere in sort of the like the last two thirds of the film, it ever so slightly drags for me personally. That is just like there's such a like a minuscule gripe against a film that is fucking fantastic. And Dune is a really interesting world and story, one that almost feels like dreamlike. And I think Villeneuve has approached these Dune films with that. I think he said before, and again, I'm just going to be paraphrasing here because I don't know the exact quote, but it's something about him saying like he wanted to sort of make Dune in the sense of like a dream almost. And it's something like it's something why I understand like why the Dune story was attached to Jodorowsky so long ago, and then also David Lynch obviously made his, which is awful. It's terrible. But you understand why Lynch was involved, and it's not really Lynch's fault that didn't work out. That's a studio problem. But no, I think you're right. I think the trajectory of these films, when we get to that sort of like end part and it's all finalized, I think you could be looking at one of the best sagas, because I don't know how many films they're planning to do, but you could be looking at one of the best sagas of all time.
Yeah.
But no, maybe I'm not in the camp that's like, this is the best film of all time, but I think that's just a thing that happens sometimes when a film came out. It happened when like Interstellar came out in like 2014. Everyone was like, wow, this is the best film ever made. And it's like, calm down. But Dune 2 is really good.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. I would say before, because I've got lots of praise of different areas, but I was going to say before I got to that, I think the biggest drawback for me, that even after seeing where the story goes, potentially it will stop me giving it 5, is sort of the pacing between the two distinct parts of the stories. There's quite distinct parts of the stories that aren't in half, but the first section of Paul being in the north of Arrakis, and then the southern section once he's passed the storms into the south of Arrakis to sort of try and unite the more rural Fremen people.
Yeah.
I think those are quite two distinctive parts. And I think that the pacing's a little bit off. I think that first section is quite slow, and then the second section's like really, really sped up. It's got quite a much faster pace, but there is no sort of like gradual transition into it. It's kind of like, oh, Paul has this thing about whether or not he wants to go south because he knows this future will, or he thinks this future will come to pass, and then he does it, and then we just hit the ground running, and it's like bam, 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 all these story beats keep happening. And I get what you mean. Even with that pacing, I still think the sections that drag, because it kind of feels like we kind of know where it's going, and it's sort of like going over points that you're kind of like, okay, right, we know where we're going, let's get to it now. But even alongside that, I still think there's some incredible storytelling here. I think the scene of Paul riding the sandworm for the first time is an absolute spectacle, and it's so I don't mean to be rude to the previous incarnation, but when you compare this to that, and it's not just that, you know, I know that it was made a long time ago and the effects weren't the same, but there's no urgency to Paul mounting the worm in Lynch's one. I don't know if you've watched it recently, but he kind of just like jogs alongside it and then kind of climbs it, and it's like, as I say, don't get me wrong, I understand the effects are old, but there's just no urgency to anything that's happened. There's no tension. It's kind of just like, I guess he's scaling the side of a worm now. He's kind of just like, all right, let's just go. But with this one, if even though you know he's going to successfully mount it, you still get tension, and you still get sort of intrigue onto how it's going to go. There's plenty of things I could praise about this film, but yeah, what did you think about, as someone, because I've started reading the book now, but I'm not quite to the part where part one finishes. What did you think about the changes that are made to the story? Because I'm aware of pretty much all of the changes, I think, now. The biggest one being Zendaya's character.
So the things I really liked about the film was that I felt like Paul's arc in this film was way clearer than sort of like the one he had in the first one, because he sort of is on his way, you know, kind of like what his path is going to look like. But actually in the first film, there's not a distinct like choice he's making. Whereas here, obviously, he's got that thing where he almost doesn't want to become this, the Messiah. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. He obviously doesn't want that, but he knows that all roads are kind of leading there. And I think also with the relationship with Chaney he has, I think, by the way, which I think her story in that is great as well. I think the changes he's made there are wonderful. I think it's so present and clear, this decision that he's kind of got to make, and sort of kind of stepping up to being this Messiah without really wanting to be. I think the film makes that so clear, and I think it's wonderful. And then all the stuff of, I think one of the best things about Dune is the sort of like false Messiah stuff, in the sense that it's all manufactured and stuff. So even that bit where obviously his mother, when they are obviously with the Fremen, they are at the end of the first film, but they are become obviously more integrated into the Fremen lifestyle. What is the title? She Reverend Mother, isn't it? She becomes Reverend Mother. She then sees an opportunity to kind of build Paul as this Messiah through fear. That's like a smaller version of essentially what these Fremen people have been put through their entire sort of however long they've been there, since the Harkonnens and stuff were there. It was this like falsehood and almost like put through fear of someone helping them. So I think the book is really good with that, and I think the film handles it really well, but it also understands that it's kind of like the blockbustery sides of stuff. Yeah. And I think all of that is nailed as well. I think it's quite a smart thing at the end to show sort of, I know it's a bit of a cliffhanger, and it's kind of, I've had problems with films that have done that kind of thing before. I think of like Desolation of Smaug, the Hobbit film. That's fucking frustrating to me, that is. But here I thought it was a reasonably good place to finish, and I really liked how his arc kind of all unraveled by the end. I thought it was really good. And to be honest, my one qualm with the book is that I kind of always thought the ending was a bit sort of like sudden. So I'm quite glad there was a bit of extra.
Nice.
I thought it was really good. And I think as adaptations go, I think Villeneuve has continued to just nail it, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny too, because this film, I think, has anyone who's ever acted ever in it.
Oh, so many people in it.
There's so many people in it. And I'm not going to go out and say who's great in it, because everyone's great in it. I mean, Austin Butler, I think, is a particular highlight for me. I think he's absolutely brilliant in it. It's really funny seeing a bald Elvis try to murder people. I did see some criticism. People were giving criticism online to Christopher Walken as the Emperor.
Yeah.
And I still don't... Like they were saying, like, you know, doing that Christopher Walken voice, you know, I am the Emperor. That wasn't Christopher Walken. I don't know what that was. But do you know what I mean? Like, I didn't get that at all. Like, I think this thing Christopher Walken does that's really good about just, he constantly feels sapped of energy. He just looks weak all the time. And that just isn't something that you see from Christopher Walken very often. He usually, you know, as a person, he's quite... energy, like he's got a lot of energy about him, and on screen he usually has this really big performance and bit, or like just he's, you know, when Christopher Walken's in the room, he's that kind of actor. Whereas in this, I think it's so much subtler, and as I say, just like just constantly looking sapped. I think it's really good. I don't think the criticism for him is fair at all.
No, I liked him in this. I was a bit sort of trepidatious about the whole him being cast as the Emperor. Just because, obviously, again, the kind of person Walken is, I think especially as he's got older, and there's absolutely no problem with this, as many actors who do this as they get older, kind of just sort of like rein it in and play themselves. And obviously, Christopher Walken's voice is always sort of, as much as everyone loves it, there is a question as to whether it would work here. I think he was great. I think Florence Pugh is obviously a great actress. I don't know. Obviously, I think more will happen with her I think she's a good addition to the cast. I think the casting in these films in general is brilliant. You obviously got basically just the biggest stars on earth in like Chalamet and Zendaya and people like that. But they are great in their roles. I didn't have any problem. Yeah, I liked Austin Butler as well. I thought he was really good. I think it's hard to say whether it's not like, it can't be said that you're like, oh, it's nice to see him doing something different, because, I mean, everyone kind of knows him for Elvis. I'm just happy he didn't have the Elvis voice.
I was giving him shit for Santa, but I did think it's funny that I saw people saying, do you reckon that he's going to go around sounding like a Harkonnen for 3 years now?
I hope so.
I've chip and shatter. He just goes into like restaurants and it's just like, oh, I've got a reservation. May your knife chip and shatter.
He's really good. I think he's really good in it. I think I like all the Bene Gesserit stuff as well with him.
Oh, yeah.
Leia Sado is obviously a great actress as well. I actually don't remember her from the book. It's been a while since I read it, so... I know if you're reading it, and obviously my girlfriend's reading it at the moment, maybe the both of you can refresh my memory when you get to it. I don't distinctly remember her from the book, but I'm glad Leia Sado is there because she's fucking great. I'll watch her in literally anything.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. Just before we move on, I just want to say as well that I feel like it's been spoken to death, but I just want to make sure that we highlight it here. I love everything on the planet Harkonnen. Infrared filming and like being the sort of like outside being black and white because of the black sun, and then the inside having color because they're sort of shielded from it. I think that's the kind of stuff that like it feels blockbustery. You know, you have this big sci-fi type thing that probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but you know, you don't care because visually it's stunning. It looks awesome, but its implementation I think is done so well. It's something as simple as, when you're not in the sun, you are not going to have, if you're making these rules that you have this black sun and it's kind of sapping the color out of everything, once you're shielded from the sun, you're going to gain all of that color back. I don't think there's lesser directors, I think, who wouldn't think that, and they would still have it being monochrome inside. Simple things like that, I think, is...
I'm with you there. I think as well, like little things, the little details that obviously make Dune... these films so wonderful is like on the Harkonnen's planet when they have like the fireworks, it's like that black goo like exploding in the air. It's like that's like a reoccurring theme for the Harkonnens, like that gives them personality almost like throughout the film, throughout both films.
They do feel
very distinctive, and it isn't just bold people.
Elvis running around killing people.
I thought the film was wonderful. I obviously have very minuscule levels of like problems with it, maybe pacing with the same as you. We're going to talk about some other 2024 films, but it's very easily the best film I've watched from 2024 so far. But we are unfortunately in that place where there's just a lot of random films being released that aren't always great, but it's nice that there's a big film that's really good.
Should we talk about another masterpiece then? Irish Witch.
Yep. Oh yeah, fucking hell.
I should say, by the way, the next three films we're going to talk about, I all watched in one day. I don't know why. Apparently, I hate myself. But Irish Wish is this fantastical romantic comedy starring Lindsay Lohan. Which, by the way, before I go into just talking about how fucking shit this film is... everyone looks like they're having fun, especially Lindsay Lohan. And she has not had the best go of it in her career. She's been very unfairly treated. And it's just really nice to see her having fun on screen. So I just wanted to say that if everyone enjoyed making this film, then us talking shit about it is completely moot. It's the opposite of Man of Web, because apparently everyone fucking hated that film. the actors can't stop shitting it online. But anyway, Irish Wish is one of the stupidest setups I think I've ever seen. But that, it's just sort of typical for a Netflix rom-com, I think. You have Lindsay Lohan, who is a book editor for a guy called Paul Kennedy, who's played by He's played by a guy called Alexander Vlahos. I should say, by the way, outside of Lindsay Lohan, I don't think I recognised basically anyone else in this film. But basically, he's this famous book writer, author, and he has this new book coming out that is, you know, going to be very successful, and she basically had a large part in it being written well. And she's in love with him. And then she introduces him to her friends just before the book's released. And then suddenly her best friend and the author fall in love and decide to get married in his home country of Ireland. And then she sits on a wishing chair and a saint comes out and she basically wishes she was marrying Paul instead. And then there's sort of a weird in story of a photographer who she kind of meets on the way to Ireland, who you kind of realize is the right one for her. It's so convoluted in the stupidest of ways. Like, trying to summarize the plot is painful. And it is a pretty painful watch. Nothing really makes sense. It's completely nonsensical. I don't think the film is particularly bothered about trying to make sense, though. It's just, I laughed aloud at this a lot. I don't think I laughed aloud at the things I was supposed to laugh aloud at.
No.
No one is good in this film. I feel like this is one of those films, I haven't looked this up beforehand, but if the writer or director was what someone might call American Irish, which is their great 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 grandparents moved to America 100 years ago and they still claim that they're Irish and they want to make a film about their home country in quotation marks, that's what it kind of feels like. It feels like a caricature of Ireland. All of the Irish accents are fucking terrible. The main character who's supposed to be Irish, Paul, he has a terrible Irish accent. And then the main love story between Lindsay Lohan and the photographer, whose name is James, a guy called Ed Spleeliers
or something, yeah.
He's English and she's American. And it's called Irish Wish and it's set in Ireland. It's like, do you not think that it might have been a good idea to have one of your main characters be Irish, actually sound Irish, and your main sort of love interests probably be Irish? It feels like, especially knowing being English people, knowing how Ireland in general feels towards England, having the main love interest be an Englishman who's loved by Irish people wherever he goes, feels quite insulting.
Well, this is the first thing I was going to say. Someone needs to tell the makers of this film that Ireland is not in the UK, because multiple times they keep going, okay, yeah, this is Paul Kennedy. He's an Irish writer and he's the most popular writer in the UK. And they say it so many times. And I'm like, okay, fair enough. If he was, he may be the most popular writer in the UK, but they seem to make a point of it as if he's like from the UK. And you're like, no, but I think, and it's not even me being like from the UK who would have a problem with this. It's the Irish people watching this who are like, why the fuck do they think
I'm trying to remember,
we are in the UK?
I'm trying to remember if, because they do say where it's from. I wonder if the whole film is set in Northern Ireland, but they don't say that. They just say Ireland. They never say either the Republic or Northern Ireland. It's like they kind of forget that the country is split in two. But I don't know. It didn't actually set. I don't remember where it said it was set. And I'm going to be honest, I don't think it's worth looking up, because
I think it is. I think it is Republic of Ireland, because I think at some point they mentioned Dublin.
I think you're right, actually.
I don't know why more of this, more of the information has stuck with me more than Dune did.
I don't know why. It's honestly, the whole time I was kind of like, this is spectacularly bad. But it, do you know what? It's the kind of film that I could definitely recommend to people. It's a straight one star. There's nothing really redeeming about it. But it's like 80 minutes long and it's just like complete nonsense. And you can just laugh at it and have a good time.
This is like, I don't know if you've ever managed to catch like a Hallmark movie from America.
Yeah.
I know, Yeah, I like, feel like I know me and you have actually watched the Hallmark Channel. We ended up watching it when we were in LA. I don't know why I remember that, because I remember it was awful. And it's literally that. Almost like meant to be some fucking like visual fucking like brochure to Ireland, but it's somehow offensive to Ireland.
Oh my god, it's just crap, isn't it?
Everyone's bad in it. It feels like the dialogue is just like fucking awful. So there's so many moments you can pick out and say that's awful, but the one for me is her other friend, not the friend who's getting married to Paul Kennedy, but the other friend. Her and Paul are like riding by on their bikes. Lindsay Lohan and Paul Kennedy are like riding on their bikes, and the other two are picking apples for some fucking reason. I'm not going to get into the convoluted plot, but one of them goes off with Paul on the bike. Lindsay Lohan stays with her other friend. She's just like, "Would you like to pick apples?" And I was like, "That is arguably the worst line delivery I've ever heard." I don't know what it was. It just infuriated me.
Do you not think that this film feels like it was written by AI as well?
Yeah, absolutely.
This is the second Netflix film I've seen recently where I can't remember what the first one. The first one was called something like "We Have a Ghost" or something like that.
And
a lot of the interactions don't feel like humans wrote them. These aren't conversations that people really have. And it's like, I get that there's not good writers out there. I'm one of them. I'm not a good writer. Whenever I've written anything, I do struggle to make good dialogue. But I also know how basic human conversation goes.
Yeah.
And it is not this. Yeah. It is not how people sound in this film. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's AI dragged into this somewhere.
So this is directed by Janine Damian, who just before the podcast I was having a look. She directed the other, like, sort of Lindsay Lohan comeback movie on Netflix, Falling for Christmas, is it?
Yeah, I didn't watch it, but yeah.
And she's also sort of directed a couple of others, one called like Paris Christmas something. And they all feel like factory generated Hallmark movie.
Yeah.
She's obviously someone who is very well versed at just kind of doing the very basics of telling this story. And I think the kind of movies on the Hallmark Channel are ones that are like, you're not looking for anything particularly spectacular. What you're actually looking for, I think what people have maybe sort of like, people who don't really care about watching good movies, the very basic things of what attracts people to movies is like romance and a little bit of fantasy, whatever. I think that's what they've just done here. And it just feels very factory generated. Something that go into as well in the next film we talk about. But yeah, Irish Wish is, I would say, in a nutshell, you're so bad that you may actually have a good time.
Yeah.
But it's still terrible.
Oh, it's awful. It's absolutely awful. Yeah, it's shocking. I mean, it's funny, actually. I think, like, this, the next film, were both one stars for me. But they're one stars in completely different ways, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a good way to move on to the next film, which is seems to be the biggest joke in Hollywood at the moment, especially after the Oscars, which we hadn't seen it by then, but now you do get them all, is Madame Web, Sony's Madame Web, which is... So Madame Web is a character from the Spider-Man universe. This all happened sort of pre-Spider-Man.
It's 2004, isn't it?
In 2003, which, other than a Britney Spears song, does it really look like 2003? So it's about Cassandra Webb, who is played by Dakota Johnson. Her mother was pregnant with her and was in the Amazon rainforest finding a specific type of spider. Her mother dies in childbirth, kind of. And this apparently is sort of given Cassandra Webb sort of almost like a clairvoyancy. And when someone is out to get these three young teenage girls, she kind of intervenes and tries her best to help them. As I said, this is from the Spider-Man universe. There is... So apparently at one point there was a point to make out, like, to even mention Peter Parker, who's very clearly in the film, but as an unborn child, because her partner, she is a paramedic. Her partner is Ben Parker, obviously Spider-Man's uncle. She's at a baby shower of his sister, which would be Spider-Man's mom. But apparently before the film, they wanted to cut out all sort of reference to Peter Parker, but still managed to keep, obviously can't really get rid of Ben Parker. And then also apparently at one point, so the film is kind of, it's an action film because the climax is just a fucking hot mess of shit CGI action. But apparently at one point they were told to promote this film as a suspense thriller. Where they've got that from, I have no fucking idea. But what it seems to be is an absolute production nightmare. Very clearly, Dakota Johnson didn't want to be there at all. I think it just seems like a production nightmare, a marketing nightmare, and they've never really known what this film is. And I think it absolutely shows in the final product. This is
absolutely
one of the most frustrating watches I've had in a long time.
Yeah. Can I I have a couple of questions. I have no idea if you're going to be able to answer.
Yeah.
Because I watched this quite late at night. I watched this after I watched Damsel and Irish Wish. So my brain was already just completely fucking it was seeping out of my ears. So maybe I just missed it. But I had a few questions. Why does the villain have a Spider-Man suit? He looks like Spider-Man. Explain? Is it just because he has spidery powers?
Explained, and also this is not an explanation, but I assume obviously because obviously at the start when they're getting the spider from the Amazon forest, there's like there's obviously that tribe of people who kind of look like spider people. And it's almost like he's taken that. It's somewhere like halfway between that and then the actual Spider-Man suit. But it's never explained as to why he actually would need this suit. Like, does he want this suit? So, no. It makes no sense.
Is it ever explained as to why people sometimes can't see him? Because, like, for some reason, Dakota Johnson and three teenage girls can see him. But then there's sections where other people can't see him. Like, on the train and in the diner, they make a point of saying that people can't see him. Like when they're leaving the train, the police are trying to arrest Dakota Johnson because they think she's abducting the three girls, but they can't see I can't remember what the villain's name is. Ezekiel Sims. I do not remember that being his name at all, but there you are.
No, me neither.
He's like chasing them down to try and kill these three girls, but the police can't see him, and they make a point of saying that the police can't see him. Did I miss an explanation as to why?
I feel like, this is not an explanation at all, but I feel like the film is trying to make out that in that train section, he is almost like camouflaged because he's in a black suit and he's on the roof. And it's meant to be that, like, everything he did, you can't really see. But you're right, because he then attacks
He walks along the platform attacking the police people and they don't see him.
Yeah.
And that, there's a whole.
That's,
you know,
never
I mean?
Explained then. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No. Because there's that thing of like she steals the cab to try and get away from him.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, this thing happened. Police were attacked, blah, blah, blah. And Johnson's like, oh, yeah, cool. They're going to catch him. And then they say it's her, and there's no mention of him. So I didn't know. The only thing is, because we said about how much of a hot mess this film is, this film does a really fucking awful job of ever explaining anything. It's so clear. They were making it up as it goes along. So I just wondered if they were threads that they had ideas for but never actually followed through with. Maybe somewhere along the line they had an explanation, but they just can't.
I have no idea. I think the thing, I don't know if you noticed this as well, but there's two times in this, I kind of gave up looking for them, but there's two times in this where I'm pretty sure the characters actively either look at the camera or stand. There's one where Dakota Johnson literally stands up and the camera wobbles like for a split second, like as in she stood up and almost like walked into the camera, and it was very, very subtle. But like, I'm like, if that gets in, then I'm not expecting anything from this storytelling.
No. I mean, there's just next up. So the simple things as well, like Ezekiel Sims, and I should say as well, I'm not blaming necessarily anyone involved in this film, from writers, directors, actors. I think just in general, this was an absolutely disgustingly hot mess, like you said, and it feels very, very production. Like, I'm not saying that they don't bear some of the blame for not putting in effort to try and save the film, but it feels very, very much like studio intervention all the way through.
Absolutely.
Something,
yeah.
Something as simple like Ezekiel Sims, his dialogue was very, very clearly changed ADR, and they didn't go back to do reshoots. So the sections where his ADR, where additional dialogue recording, his dialogue, it doesn't match what his lips are saying because they were changing.
Yes.
What he was saying. And they don't make any effort to actually make it make sense, which is, it just, it's things like that that separate this from a one-star film from Irish Wish, where I don't think they were trying to make Irish Wish good, but also I don't think they were particularly concerned about that. Like, that, at least there was competency in the basic filmmaking stuff.
Absolutely, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it, they weren't setting out to make a masterpiece, they were just making this silly little film, whatever. Madame Web feels like they were trying to set up this big next stage of the Sony Spider-Man multiverse. And
yeah,
it's just mistake after mistake after mistake that no one goes back and clears up for. And it just doesn't feel like anyone cared whether this was good, whether this was bad. It's a shame. It's a right shame, because I think for me, again, like Irish Wish, it's 80 minutes. It's like in, out, stupid, whatever. Have your fun. With this, I think the first half an hour or so is nonsensical. It's ridiculous. Like each plot point makes less sense than the last, and then when Dakota Johnson has the girls and then takes them into the woods in the middle of nowhere for some reason, there's about an hour where it's just fucking dull. It's so boring.
That's so dull.
And then the last half an hour just gets back to being a hot mess, as you said. That last action sequence in the firework building is so fucking stupid, but at least it's like some level of entertainment. It's ridiculous and you're laughing about how bad it is, but it's not dull. Like, that's, I think that's what makes this film exceptionally bad, is just how fucking shit that middle bit is. And it is just
lazy, because I just think, even down to some of the character stuff, in that, like, Sydney Sweeney, for example, and Sydney Sweeney's come out and said that basically the reason she signed up to the movie is because it's opened other doors for her, so it's actually quite smart from her as an actress. But her character, who's meant to be, of the three girls, essentially not really any character other than one smart, one's kind of awkward and shy, and the other one's a rich girl who is kind of very, like, out there and confident and stuff like that, but is kind of, like, angry at her parents or whatever, I don't know. But, like, Sydney Sweeney is, like, the anxious, shy girl. She's obviously kind of phoning it in a little bit performance-wise, but also just shoving glasses on her. That's such an old way to, like, almost like make someone a nerd. Like, I was like, that's such a fucking lazy thing. It's little things. I mean, you've got the big things and then the little things. The whole package really is just
lazy,
and it's a shame.
It's so bad. Top to bottom is so bad. There's no character development. And there's, like, that whole thing of, like, you see what the girls look like in the future when they kind of become spider women, I guess. But it's never explained as to why they get the spider powers, other than they're kind of guided by Madame Web. But, like, what? Like, why were those three going to end up killing this guy? Because that's the whole kind of conceit of him trying to kill them, is he sees them killing him in the future. It's just bad. It's just, but, like, it doesn't make any sense, but not in a way that's fun. It's just, it's nonsensical.
The most
boring way.
The most devastating thing to me is that Adam Scott is in this.
Man.
Who obviously we both like, because we really like Parks and Rec, and he's a really good actor, both comedic and dramatically. I'm just like, I saw him in this, and I was like, oh, why did they drag you into this?
Unfortunately, he's in a lot of shit films. I don't think he's particularly bothered. I've always got the impression from him as an actor, he's not particularly bothered about whether he makes complete trash or an Oscar winner, because he's in some amazing stuff. He just cashes those paychecks, you know?
Oh, yeah. Let's be honest. Everyone in this film was cashing a paycheck. Dakota Johnson, definitely. I mean, there is obviously very famous films of sort of maybe the main star is not having a good time. But I think of something like Daniel Craig in Spectre. To me, that's always the one where you're like, Daniel Craig just doesn't want to be there. Dakota Johnson literally couldn't give two shits. Like, I think in the right film, Dakota Johnson's really good. But, like, She's obviously not good in this, and I don't think she was trying to be good. I don't think she gave a shit at all.
No, absolutely, absolutely. Can we move on? So there is an infinite amount of complaints we could have with this film. Shall we move on then? So the next one is another Netflix film, because they're cranking these babies out. It's a film called Damsel, starring Millie Bobby Brown. She plays a princess, I guess, called Elodie. She basically lives in, I don't know if it's ever specifically said where it is, but she lives with her family in this desolate kind of place that's really, really struggling. It's like barren, it's cold, there's no money. And her father, who's played by Ray Winston, and then her stepmother, which is Angela Bassett, which I feel like that's the best thing about this film, making you think that Angela Bassett and Ray Winston could be a married couple. It's great. But yeah, they basically are really, really struggling, and then they get this invitation from this very, very rich kingdom to marry the prince. They get loads of money. She gets to live happily ever after. And then suddenly you realize that they're actually paying a debt to a dragon. And there's this whole thing of they get married, they cut their hands, the prince and the princess, rub the blood together, she becomes of royal blood, and then they chuck her in the dragon pit, and dragon tries to eat her. This film opens up by saying something along the lines of how this isn't your average fairy tale. And I think there's something in the core of this film, I think, so somewhere there is a good film and an interesting story of sort of subverting fairy tale expectations. I tried to describe this to someone at my work, and they were like, oh, so it's basically Shrek then. I was like, yeah, I mean, it's subverting fairy tales, you know, I guess so. I think this is just another film, though, that I think succumbs to Netflix's like massive machine. It's just a cog in the machine. It's just something else that's churned out. No one is particularly good in this film. I mean, I love Angela Bassett, but she is not good in this film at all. Ray Winston, I don't know, I thought Ray Winston gives it his best, but you know, it reminds me a little bit of his performance in Black Widow, where it's just like, yeah, why would you cast him in this role? It just doesn't work. It's just sort of a bit of a mess of crap CGI, kind of boring plotting, because like I feel like where the film stumbles too much for me is so much of it is just Millie Bobby Brown running away from the dragon in the dragon cave, and it's just kind of like, okay, we get the point. And like very, very early on, you pretty much get what the story is that the rich kingdom is lying, they're the bad guys, and that Millie Bobby Brown's probably going to team up with the dragon. And then it still takes like an hour and a half to get there, and you're kind of like, right, let's get to the fucking point now. Let's get to the fucking point. Go on.
Again, I'm sorry. So I have a question for you now, because I feel like you watched this before me.
Yeah.
And maybe you... Was this the first one of your Irish Wish, Damsel, Madam Web?
Yeah, it went Irish Wish. Sorry, it went Damsel, Irish Wish, Madam Web. So honestly, God, it was the best triple bill of my life. It's not the time I watched like four Halloween films in one day, and my brain just collapsed.
You know how? So obviously, yeah. So for like the majority of it is basically Millie Bobby Brown doing Die Hard with a dragon, where she's just like moving around this like cave trying to avoid the dragon. And then her father comes to get her. Is it ever explained why her father actually knows that that's happening? That he knows that his daughter's been chucked off a thing into the dragon pit?
I don't think they explicitly say it, but it's very... like I think he says that I made a mistake. So it's pretty clear that he knew where he was selling her for money.
Right, fair.
Because there's that bit when they first get there, there's sort of a bit of unevenness where he's having meetings with the queen, who's played by Robin Wright.
Yeah.
And stuff like that, and there's a bit of sort of strange stuff going on, and he won't tell anyone what's going on, and Angela Bassett is like, something's going on, and I know we haven't always been close, but you shouldn't go through the wedding, blah 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 blah, but
right, yeah, of course, like, yeah,
do you know what I mean? So he isn't ever explicitly said that he knew I am selling you for a while, but I think it's pretty yeah, pretty heavily insinuated. So,
oh, that's fair, right? That was to me when that happened. I was just like, how? Why is he there? But I mean, it's got an answer. That's fine. Yeah, I mean, you're like you said, Netflix is a big machine. There's a problem here with all these films, minus Dune, obviously. That is sort of that like factory processed sort of film. And but like we've said, though, I feel like somewhere in there was a great idea of what could have potentially been a good film. But I don't think anyone's particularly good in it. I don't think the direction is particularly inspired. I will say this, I liked the dragon. I thought the voice acting was great. I thought it was good voice. I think the only thing I'd actually seen the actress in was X-Men Last Stand, because I did recognise the voice, and I was like, where do I know that from? And it was really, she plays a doctor in X-Men Last Stand. I mean, I think the CGI, the backdrops are pretty shit. Yeah. But I think the dragon is pretty good. That was kind of the one thing I picked up. I enjoyed everything surrounding the dragon.
Yeah.
Everything else was kind of like, it was either fine or it was, to me, quite weak. There's a lot of good people in this. Like you said, Angela Bassett's great. I don't think she's particularly good in it, but it's Angela Bassett. She's wonderful. I really like Robin Wright as well. It's a shame she's not amazing in it either.
No, and she's on the screen for probably about 47 seconds. So
yeah. But no, this it's just that promise of having like a fantasy thing of... like you've never seen before. And I do get the whole play on the damsel, like the damsel in distress thing, kind of defending herself and in turn coming the hero. I really like that, but like you said, there is something here that could have been good, but unfortunately the film just is kind of paced weird and is just a bit just not great.
It's nice having a film that, even though this is still pretty crap, it's nice going from Irish Wish and Madam Web to talk about this a little bit, because it isn't a hot mess. It isn't nonsensical. It does make sense. It's just not very good. And I feel like everyone was trying their best with what they had, but it kind of just, or not necessarily their best. I still think a lot of people rein it in, but it's like, no one is just doing what everyone did in Madam Web, which is just like, I don't give a fuck. You know, that.
Yeah.
I do think people are trying, and they did try to make something out of it. It's just a shame it went the way it went. And I just looked it up as well. The guy who wrote the film has only written three films before, which is this, Fast X, and Wrath of the Titans. So he doesn't exactly have a particularly good writing career.
No.
Bless him. I mean, you know, he's getting paid to write. You know, I guess that's something.
Yeah, that's true. I suppose, I think it makes the big distinction, doesn't it, between a one star and a two star, and what we consider to be the distinction is that something has to be pretty fucking horrible to give it a one star. Yeah. And Damsel is nowhere near that. It's a film, a very complete film, I guess, that just had a lot of problems, and that's kind of whereas Madam Web and Irish Wish were. I was about to say Irish Web.
Irish Web, oh my god.
And Madam Wish.
To be fair, can you imagine Irish
that crossover.
Wish, but she sits on the wishing chair and she goes, I wish I was Madam Web. And then,
oh my god, so good.
Sydney
the crossover we didn't know we needed.
Yeah, there you go. Perfect film.
Yeah, I'm not surprised you nearly lost your mind after this one day of watching all three of these films.
God, I'm on night shifts as well this week, so I'm just not sleeping. So it was, the day I watched it was a bit like a hallucination, I'm going to be honest. Should we go into the real rewind then?
Like I said at the beginning of the podcast, this is a slightly different real rewind. Obviously, we are talking about old films, but it's more about the experience of how we watch them, not just sat depressed on my sofa. mine was a thing in London called Taste Film, in which not just like a meal and a film, it is a sort of experience where they play a film for you and they try and match the food to the film, basically. And it's a really like really really unique experience. So me and my girlfriend went to watch Dirty Dancing, which I don't have a problem with Dirty Dancing. It's quite a fun film. I was quite intrigued to know what the food would be, because obviously you don't distinctly go, it's like a foodie film. But like it started with like this little pot roast thing. It was like a starter, so it was like a tiny little dish. And it was sort of just like beef brisket, mash and gravy and a couple of greens. And they actually then like mention it. Like, so they try and time it with when it's implemented into the film. So they mentioned it and it was really good. It kind of like, it makes you feel like it immerses you so much more. And I think it does work. And then there was things like a couple of cocktails. There's a famous scene where she's trying to carry watermelons and they brought out like a watermelon cocktail. And then there was like a leftovers thing, another cocktail, and then like a, I think the problem with doing that is obviously you can't be perfect with your timing every time, because there's like, there was quite a few people there, like 40, 50 people there. So it's quite hard, I imagine, to try and time it as well as you can. But no, it was super unique. And like, it actually, the film flies by because you're literally spending like an hour and 40 minutes just eating and drinking. Mm. I honestly couldn't move afterwards. I was so full. Like, you don't, you get your money's worth. So like, I absolutely suggest anyone who just, I mean, you can just Google Taste Film. They'll show you sort of what they've got coming up in the next month or so. And if genuinely, go and do it for the right film, I think, as well, because the Dirty Dancing one was great, and I would have never thought to that to be like a foodie film. So I just go and do it. And I said to my girlfriend, Straff, I was like, do you know what film would be great with this? Chef.
Yeah, I was thinking it'd be right, wouldn't it?
And our entire way home, we were kind of like trying to think of films that would be really good for this. I think something like Pulp Fiction would be so good as well. A big Kahuna Burger, a $5 shake. But like, if they can do this with something with Dirty Dancing, that's like just someone holding a watermelon and then eating, kind of, they're in like the restaurant quite a lot, aren't they? Yeah, sort of like very 80s food. It was really good. It was amazing. But yeah, I recommend that to anyone.
I'm definitely going to do it after. I mean, it sounded cool anyway, but after your recommendation, it sounds good. And it's nice to have those sort of unique viewing experiences that make something more. Because I don't think either of us are the kind of people who would have said, oh, Dirty Dancing is in cinema, let's go and watch it. You're happily... I this isn't the film I was going to mention, but I did go do a cocktail and film night and went and watched Little Nicky. which was an experience. It wasn't quite that level. It was far more sort of laid back. It was in a cocktail bar, which is, Little Nicky is such a fucking weird film. I haven't watched it since I was a kid. I used to love it when I was a kid, but that was
why,
an experience.
Why Little Nicky? I don't understand that choice from them at all. Absolutely. There's so many films.
Yeah, exactly.
In the world that you would pick over that.
My girlfriend hadn't seen it before, and she was laughing so hard at it. Partially because you're like, "What the fuck is going on?" It's so nonsensical. But in a way,
I do remember liking it when I was younger. Yeah. I do remember liking it when I was younger.
That's not the film I was going to talk about, though. The film I was going to talk about is one that I don't think we've ever mentioned before on the podcast: Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. We definitely haven't spoken about it enough.
I genuinely think we bring up Lord of the Rings every single podcast.
Yeah, near enough, yeah. The reason I want to talk about this, though, is I went to go and watch Return of the King in the Royal Albert Hall with a live orchestra performing the score. Now, before I go and talk about this, I just want to say there was something really interesting that they did, which is the sound mix is really different. So they quiet a lot of the sound effects and amplify the dialogue, so the film, the noise, the audio of the film is predominantly the live score and the dialogue. So they're like battle sequences, you don't hear the clashing of swords very much, but you hear the individual lines from people in the back that are obviously supposed to just fade into the background normally, which is really, really interesting. I'm sure it has something to do with the orchestra, because I imagine it would be just either distracting to the orchestra or they would miss their timings. There's a reason for it, just thought it was really interesting. But this was a really, really special experience for me. I think I said this to you after I watched it. I got quite emotional in a couple of sequences of it. Particularly the one that got me the most was the charge of the Rohirrim across Pelennor Fields in front of Minas Tirith. I mean, I love that scene anyway. It always gets me. It's one of my favourite scenes in the entire franchise, this sort of idea that they don't care if they die or not. They just need to do this to try and defeat the evil. It's so emotional. And then doing it with this live orchestra was just it's just a moment that I can't describe how much it meant to me. It's one of my favorite scores of all time anyway. The Lord of the Rings as a whole, as a trilogy, is my favorite score of all time. I don't know if it's necessarily the best, but it is my favorite, partially because of the way it uses motifs for different characters and stuff. But the scale and the epicness of it, especially when you see how many people need to be there to perform it, it's just, I can't describe to you how special it was. And I would, if anyone out there, and you know, I'd recommend for you to go and watch Return of the King.
Yeah, absolutely.
When it's in the Albert Hall. But if anyone out there has a film that they have a deep emotional connection to like this, where it's just like, this has been an integral part of my life for such a long time, and you like the score too, it has a worthy score, absolutely go and see it in concert, because it is a phenomenal experience.
Yeah, that's amazing, man. And weirdly, because we saw each other at the weekend and you told me about it. I actually got it literally the day after on my TikTok, so I've actually seen I saw the bit where they're about to charge, obviously, the gates of Mordor, and he says for Frodo, and then the music starts. I was like, "That's fucking amazing!" God.
Yeah,
so I can imagine it was so good.
It was really, really special. And something they did as well, which I wasn't expecting, is once the film finishes, they had a young boy and a woman who do the sort of singing parts that usually come through. They have the choirs as well, but you know, the individual singing parts.
Oh yeah, right, yeah.
There's that song at the end. I can't think. I think it might just be called Evenstar, but it's the one that they sing. They performed the whole credits as well. So the film finishes and then they perform the entire score over the credits as well, which
That's amazing. I don't know.
There's just something about that. And then the ovation afterwards, I'm sure they get it every single time, because we saw it at a matinee screening on a Saturday and there was like a 10-15 minute ovation. So that must get it every single time. And it was packed. Yeah. I mean, this is... it's coming towards the end of its run, because I think they did it for the 20-year anniversary of each film. So in 2021, it was like middle of 2021 into 2022 was Fellowship. And then 2022 into middle of 2023 was Two Towers. And then 2023 into the middle of 2024 is Return of the King. And if, you know, they're coming to the end of the run, usually this is where you don't get packed houses and where people have probably seen it a couple of times. But they're still getting... completely sold out 10-15 minute standing ovations, matinee screening. I think that just goes to show how much it means to just people who are going to watch it, you know.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, not again, I know we've mentioned how much we love Lord of the Rings. I think
have we?
Especially for films that sort of like, I mean, Lord of the Rings has transcended being sort of like childhood favourites. It's just something, like you said, it's been with us for our entire life. So I imagine that kind of experience is sort of just, you will never forget it, which is amazing, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, it was very, very special.
The last thing that I was going to mention, it's not really a review, it's just something that we, bit of fun that me and my girlfriend have been having. So randomly, we decided to watch 99 Homes, which is, it's a film from like 2014 with Andrew Garfield and Michael Shannon. I don't think it's a very good film, but we decided from there that what we're going to do, because to sort of find new films that I maybe have otherwise not thought about watching or anything my girlfriend wants to watch from there, we decided to take an actor from the film that we've watched and watch something else they're in and do that continuously. And it's a super interesting way to watch films randomly that you've never really thought about. So we started with 99 Homes. That was kind of just done on the cuff. We then went with Andrew Garfield. We went to Under the Silver Lake, which I know you have seen and didn't like. And admittedly, no. I didn't like either. From there, we went with Riley Keough, who I think in Under the Silver Lake, she's the blonde girl who goes missing or whatever. And he initially starts his weird, whatever you call it. We watched Zola from a few years ago, which I thought was really good. From then, because then again it came to Oscar season, Coleman Domingo's in Zola, so we used that as an excuse to watch Rustin. From there, we watched American Fiction, because Jeffrey Wright is in Rustin. We kind of landed at a place where we weren't sure where to go from there, so we kind of just used Jeffrey Wright again. We watched French Dispatch, I rewatched and my girlfriend watched for the first time. From there, it's really, it's also weird when I'm saying it in a row, because I realize there's some actors that you're like, why did I pick that film for them? I don't know why. But from Tilda Swinton, we then watched Luca Guadagnino's A Bigger Splash.
Yep.
With Dakota Johnson, which is a good Dakota Johnson performance. With him, Ralph Fiennes, Tilda Swinton, and Matthias Schoenaerts. I'm not sure if that's a full pronunciation. He's a Belgian actor, but you'd recognize his face, definitely. And then from there, we went to Amsterdam, which was released a couple of years ago, which was David O. Russell's like last film, and it's terrible. And also, I didn't realize that David O. Russell was obviously been in trouble for some stuff, so I probably wouldn't have picked that if I knew that. But yeah, it's terrible. But yeah, from there, we've picked Robert De Niro, which is what I mean. Like, we've gone with Robert De Niro. The film we've picked is a film from 1991 called Backdraft, which I know a lot of people know of, especially in America. About Fireman. We haven't watched that yet, but that's the next one we're going to watch. And I'm quite excited for it. But I'm enjoying it, because it just, I feel like ever since I was like 16 and I've had sort of like a watch list and been a nerd and almost like continuously know what I'm going to come up to watch, it's quite nice just to have that thing of just being like, fuck it, let's just stick it on and see what happens. Yeah. It's been really fun. I would recommend it. Admittedly, we probably haven't had a great run of films, but it's definitely worth doing something like that.
But the thing is, with that sort of thing, is that you'll definitely be watching films that you wouldn't normally watch, which I think is so good. Like, sometimes we get a little bit bogged down by only watching the best of films ever. And I think that's great to go back and watch Tarkovsky and stuff like that that we haven't seen. That's great. But sometimes you just want to put on some shit. Or just you like someone and you want to watch something they do. You know, it's nice to just not have to be almost burdened by the fact that you have to watch this five-star classic that you were supposed to study in film school. I think that's really nice. I think it's a really good way of doing it. I have a different method, like what I did the other day with the three films we spoke about today. I go, I'm going to watch a bad film, and then I watch loads in one day.
And then you start hallucinating and your brain starts melting.
Yeah,
same kind of meltdown you had when you watched like all those Halloween films in one day out of order.
When I watched four Halloween films out of order. Three of them were terrible. Not quite that. I mean, that I think I permanently altered my brain chemistry by doing that.
To be fair, the one complaint that we've had is that because it's nice to watch a new film together, obviously, because I have had no life since I was 16, I've watched a lot. So finding a film that it sounds like I'm bragging, but I'm not. It kind of is actually kind of depressing. It's just like, try and film just like a normal film that maybe I haven't seen and we can both watch. It turns out it's quite a lot harder than thinking. But I've kind of just said I'm happy to rewatch anything, because to be honest, I watched during university, I watched films at such a rate, I can honestly not tell you what half the films I've watched are about. So it's good for a rewatch, though. But it's fun. Yeah, it's fun. That's kind of all we've got for the review show today. Amazingly, I think this is the first time we've ever had 2 1-star films to review. Like, it's very rare that we do dish them out, but for 2 in a row is pretty brutal. If you want to talk to us, you know, give us your opinion on whether why Madame Web is the best film ever made, or why Irish Wish is the best film ever made, please get in touch. We're on realreviewing.com, where you can find other articles and stuff that we've done, any reviews. We're also on Letterboxd. I'm at Corey S. Jordan.
I'm at Phil So Well So.
Phil, why don't you run everyone through all the handles on social media, because I am useless.
You're fucking useless. You're useless. we're on Facebook, X, Instagram, Threads at Real Reviewing, and then we're on Tumblr and Letterboxd at Reviews From Real. That's kind of it. Those are the ones we're at.
Yeah. I'm glad you do that, because I mean, I've only just learnt my Letterboxd handle.
I said my Letterboxd handle wrong. I'm Filson Wilson, not Filso Wilso. There's ends at the end of my name. So I'm the one who messed up this time. But the difference is that mine's kind of like a play on my name. Yours is just your name and you always forget it.
Literally it literally is, yeah. One day we'll be good at this housekeeping stuff. Yeah, and also, you know, Taste Film, if you want to sponsor this podcast, please reach out. You know, I've given you a pretty glowing review there. So,
yeah, Royal Albert Hall. Yeah. With your Philharmonic.
Andrew Garfield. Andrew Garfield, if you want to sponsor us, mate.
I don't think he wants to, after, like, I know we didn't review Under the Silver Lake, but.
Yeah, to be fair, I did just say the two films I watched of his were both not very good. So maybe he doesn't want to do that.
No. But to Kurt Johnson, come on. Come on the show. You'll have a better time than Madame Web. That's it for today's episode. A bit of a fucking clusterfuck at the end. But I hope you enjoyed listening and I hope to catch you in the next one.
Bye.